and welcome to the Trek Companion Podcast, Episode 6. Today we are going to be discussing the first four episodes of Deep Space Nine's second season, Homecoming, The Circle, The Siege, and Invasive Procedures. I am your host, Brian Williams.
I am Adam Caesar.
I'm Stephen Embry.
And today we have a guest. I know I promised a guest a couple episodes back, but believe it or not, it's very difficult to schedule, you know, all these people in two different time zones. So we have a guest today, by God, and his name is Brian McCaughey. Hello, Brian.
Hi, everyone.
So if it's not confusing enough that we have two Adams involved in the production of this show, there are now two Brians.
That's right.
Right. We're going to do one little thing different today, because the first three episodes of Deep Space Nine's second season are one storyline. We are going to discuss them and treat them basically as just that, as one piece. So we're going to do everything we would normally do, just kind of a little bit longer, as if it was one long episode. And then when we jump to and Brian is only joining us for those three, and then we'll jump to Invasive Procedures and treat that fourth episode just like we would normally treat an episode. All right, so here we go.
The Homecoming, Season 2, Episode 1, Production Number 421. Original air date, September 26th, 1993. Teleplay by Ira Stephen Bear. Story by Jerry Taylor and Ira Stephen Bear. Directed by Winrick Colby. The Circle, Season 2, Episode 2, Production Number 422. Original air date, October 3rd, 1993. It's written by Peter Allen Fields, directed by Corey Allen, and The Siege, Season 2, Episode 3, Production Number 423, original air date October 10th, 1993, written by Michael Piller, directed by Winrick Colby. Guest cast include Richard Beimer as Lee Nalis, Max Gradenchik as Rom, Michael Bell as Borum, Mark Alamo as Gul Dukat, Stephen Macht as Krim, Bruce Gray as Admiral Chakotay, Philip Anglim as Vedic Barail, Rosalind Chow as Keiko O'Brien, Stephen Weber as Colonel Day, Aaron Eisenberg as Nog, Hannah Hatte as Molly O'Brien, Louise Fletcher as Vedic Wynn, and Frank Langella as Minister Jaro.
In the Homecoming, Kira learns of the possible survival of Lee Nalis, the greatest Bajoran resistant fighter during the occupation. She sees this as an opportunity to bring a factionalized Bajoran people together. After careful thought, Sisko agrees to risk the fragile Cardassian relations and let Kira go after Lee. Upon Lee's rescue, we learn that the legend of Lee Nalis is greater than the man himself, and Sisko must convince him that Bajor needs the legend more than the man. In the Circle, Sisko must deal with political maneuvering when Kira is reassigned by Minister Jaro and Lee Nalis is made his new first officer. Furthermore, the station has been vandalized by a Bajoran political group called the Circle, which calls for the removal of the Federation from Bajor. Kira accepts an invitation by Vedic Barail to his ministry, where she is kidnapped by the Circle for information about Sisko. She also learns Minister Jaro is the leader of the Circle. Meanwhile, with the help of Odo, Quark learns that the Cardassians are shipping weapons to the Circle through a third party, the Kasarians. Kira is rescued by Lee Nalis and Sisko, but when they return to DS9, they learn that Minister Jaro has taken control of the Bajoran government and is sending warships to DS9 to remove the Federation. In the Siege, Sisko must evacuate DS9 per Starfleet orders, but he has a plan to save the fragile Bajoran government and keep the Federation from leaving. Also keeping the Cardassians from returning. To do this, Sisko must stay behind with his officers and wage a shadow war with the Bajoran troops on DS9 to buy time for Kira and Dax to deliver the proof to the Ministry of Bajor that the Cardassians are behind the Circle's power to take over Bajor.
So, you're involved with the Circle?
I am the Circle, Matron.
Now I understand why you wanted to ship Lee Nalis off to the station.
The last thing I need right now is a great war hero capturing the devotion of the Bajoran people.
How can you betray your own government?
Major, I don't have to tell you. I've heard your opinion of this government. Government. They can't even agree it is a government, so they call it provisional. It's just another word for powerless.
So a three-parter, that's very unusual for Star Trek.
Is this the only time, or was there one other?
I had to look it up, actually.
Enterprise.
A couple of times in Enterprise, but this was the first time they'd done it, and, you know, at this point, And they didn't do it again until, you know, the last Star Trek series, Enterprise. So it is unusual. There are some obvious plus sides to that. You know, I was thinking about it. They took their time with a lot of stuff, although there were a few times where I felt like they didn't, you know, maybe they would have been better off not doing that. But this was their effort to kind of kick off season two with this big storyline that kind of picked up with what was happening at the end of the first season, you know, with the Bajorans, their fragile political system, of course, ever since what's her bird? the Kai,
you know, Opaka, yeah,
right. Opaka was lost, and now Bajor's in turmoil and everything. But one of the reasons I wanted to have Brian on was because I'm really curious how it holds up, A, almost 20 years later, and B, if it works for someone who isn't a Star Trek fan. Because I'm not, I mean, Brian likes Star Trek and all, but he's not, you know, he's not like us, the nutty fans.
He usually has plans on Friday night. Is that what you're saying?
You gave away our secret.
I'm in a nightclub right now. I'm a fan of Star Trek, but like of cinematic Star Trek. So I'm not necessarily a fan of
You love J.J. Abrams' movie.
I love all the movies, you know, and especially the J.J. Abrams movies. So I think maybe it was a good idea for me to watch this because this story had a little more time to breathe, you know. So it was, you know, some big things did happen here. But my question is, was this like the first episode or the first story arc for a new season, like season two or something like that?
Yeah.
So this was kind of like the lead-in episode?
Exactly. This was kicking off season two. And they ended season one with kind of a big political assassination controversy thing with Bajor.
It really wasn't a cliffhanger, though.
It wasn't a cliffhanger. But
it just kind of got things started.
But okay. my memory of this trilogy, of these three episodes, was that maybe there was too much space, that maybe it doesn't really hold up for non-Star Trek people. You know, it's not like as I was describing it to Brian, this is not the cream of DS9's crop. These aren't bad.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason it's an interesting question, I think, is because they seem to be going for something different. I'm not sure how successful they were. But at any rate, let's break it down in more of our traditional way. So the main thing I remember from these, which is still one of the best things in there, is Frank Langella. Frank Langella is
Skeletor.
Awesome. Yeah. he's an absolute legend. Mm-hmm. I left Brian and I just saw a movie with him last week.
Unknown,
yeah. He's still going strong. He's in his 70s. I love the way he delivers his lines. It's a lot like Louise Fletcher, you know, just like every word, he kind of chews him up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What he did today was propose war with Cardassia or whatever he says to Kira, and then he says thankfully they declined the invitation, you know.
Yeah.
Something about his speech patterns that's so awesome and sells it. And honestly, I don't know that his character was written all that great. He doesn't have that many great lines, but he sure delivers every one of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's kind of more episodes, but in the end, then you kind of see it towards the end when we get to it. He kind of flickers out really fast.
Yeah, and that's the same thing that happens with Lee Nollis. Because this first episode, this whole Rambo First Blood Part 2 thing, that's kind of cool. And the Lee Nollis is as a character is kind of interesting in here. But nothing happens to him in the second and third episodes. You kind of feel like, why is he even here?
Yeah, you just know? There wasn't any kind of real strength to the man, to the character. I mean, you know, they create this. I see the counter argument they're making. The man is it the legend, but you know, there's some truths to legend. You know,
I like that. I like that storyline. You know, that idea. You know, that the symbol is more important than the fact.
Right. You know? I agree. But I mean, I think they could have made his character a little bit stronger to kind of fit that. Even if he didn't accept the legend, there's some truths to legend, so I think they kind of made him a little bit weaker than they needed to sell their point.
In the second and third episodes.
Yeah, Okay, yeah, I'd agree with that.
I think that's the weakness of this trilogy, not the cast, but the characters, the guest characters. You know, I don't think they go anywhere. You know, they have these people, and there's kind of a promise of interesting things, yeah, and it doesn't totally fulfill it.
Incredibly well cast.
Yeah,
but, yeah. I wonder though, do you think it would have been stronger if they tried, if they'd done it in 2 hours instead of three?
Possibly.
Maybe like cut some small element out of the whole arc and go ahead and consolidate into two, maybe, yeah.
Well, like the C, they're kind of interesting. I mean, you can tell each one was kind of written by a different person. Mm-hmm. They don't blend as well as, say, you think about like the end of DS9, those last 10 episodes. Remember mm-hmm. that?
Right.
Mm-hmm. It just feels like you're watching one 10-hour episode. It's crazy. Here, these feel like three distinct episodes. You know, like the third mm-hmm. one, The Siege, it's very action-y. You know,
yeah.
it's very different.
Yeah, I mean, it's
the battle in the sky. It's very, very actiony.
And it's cat and mouse, actually.
Yeah. So each one just feels very different. I kind of like the idea of them taking their time, like in Homecoming, when Sisko has to make the decision about giving Kira the runabout. That's like three scenes. And in a normal 46-minute episode of Star Trek, they would have done that. The scene mm-hmm. when she sat down with him at the lunch table or whatever, they would have done it in that scene. He would have said, mm-hmm. "Okay, you can have the runabout." Yeah. So I kind of like that. There was a
Why did he give her the runabout anyway? I mean, that was a really. I mean, it's cool. I mean, the episode never happens if he doesn't do that. But isn't he really like out of line? Could you imagine? Like, he almost sent her looking for weapons of mass destruction that don't exist. But you know, almost even worse. I mean, can you imagine the embarrassment if he sent her out there and they broke into the Cardassia planet and then there was totally wrong. Like, no, this is just an earring that was made in a Chinese factory, a warehouse. We make these all the time.
Well, I would agree with you. A lot of that happens in this episode where things just work out perfectly, and it's kind of fragile the whole way through. You know, everything goes completely their way.
I remember the first time I saw Homecoming, I thought it was a big setup. I thought it was all fake. I thought, like, Lee Nollis was actually going to be a Cardassian, you know,
yeah,
like with skin job or something.
There wasn't going to be any Lee Nollis. There would actually be no person named Lee Nollis, and that was just a legend that got passed down. So,
yeah,
that's partially right.
But that everything does work so perfectly. Yeah. You know what it is? It feels, in contrast to, say, the last two or three episodes of the first season, these episodes feel a little more dated to me.
Yeah.
They feel more like, I don't know, like they have like the pacing of Next Gen from the late 80s almost.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you think, I mean, because literally in the first season, they didn't do a whole lot. You didn't really learn a lot about Bajor in the first season. You got glimpses here and there. But, I mean, except for the one episode, and that was on a moon. That wasn't like Bajor where they had to take him off the moon. But, yeah, I didn't really feel like they did a whole lot of Bajor setup, and then they kind of just squeezed it all in.
Let me ask you this. If they had dropped, if they never made these three episodes, mm-hmm. what difference would it have made to the history of Bajor?
Probably not much.
And see, I guess that's what I'm getting at, you know?
Okay.
Then why? But I don't know. Maybe I'm bad-mouthing these things. And there were plenty of things in here I like. Maybe I should talk about that for a minute. The beginning of the circle, that scene in Kira's quarters, is so unlike Star Trek. It's so unlike everything else, but the other episodes. But that scene is so awesome. You know the scene I'm talking about?
Which scene? Are you talking about the scene where everybody starts showing up?
Yeah, everybody starts showing up.
They've got their dialogue. That's like an Ally McBeal episode.
Their dialogue's kind of almost overlapping. It's very like a play or something.
Yeah.
Even the opening scene in Homecoming with Quark and Odo, that was just a classic banter back and forth because, you know, Quark gave up some information to him.
Oh, right.
Odo couldn't figure out why. But yeah, the first opening scene of Homecoming I enjoyed. But I always enjoyed Quark and Odo's bantering. So I guess I'm kind of biased there.
See, look, I'm trying to go over my notes to say other things positive, and I keep finding negative things. The circle is so on the nose evil that it kind of takes some of the power and drama out of it for me. When Jaro insists that they just torture Kira for the information about the Federation.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I think it would have been much more interesting. Yeah, it would have been much more interesting if there was an element to the circle that we could sympathize with.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah,
what if Jaro wasn't just this, you know, evil,
politically hungry fellow?
Yeah. What if there was more to it? There was an episode in the first season where somebody that loved Bajor was a terrorist. I think it was like the first one of the very first episodes.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. He wanted to blow up the wormhole because he loved Bajor. You know, not because he didn't want to get rid of outsiders so that he could, I don't know, lead the planet or something.
Yeah,
he thought it was best for the planet, for his people. You know, that's a lot more interesting to me when it's not so black or white, I guess.
I got you. Yeah, Charles just wants the best for him.
I sympathize with the circle because it's the 24th century and there's phasers and transporters and communicators, and these guys use spray paint. who could not feel sorry for them?
I like early on in there where they see the first graffiti and it's like O'Brien's just appalled that they marked on
exactly. It's so upsetting.
It did make me think this never happens in Star Trek.
What is this? Paint.
Yeah. And how hard would it be to get it off? I'll let you just some little gadget probably just swipe it across and the paint.
They got a scar off of Quark like within seconds, you know. So I imagine some spray paint wouldn't be so.
And that's pretty horrific. They branded him right on his forehead.
Wow, yeah.
I do like the character of Jaro.
I think you like the actor.
Yeah, that's true. Love the actor. Isn't it great to see him? And I just wish his character wasn't so on the nose evil. But wasn't it great to see him and Louise Fletcher? Those scenes, those couple of scenes they had together, just the two of them, those were probably the best scenes out of all three things for me.
Is Louise Fletcher the evil nun? Is that how that was?
Yeah.
Where else is she from? She looks very familiar.
She won an Oscar for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, she's Nurse Ratched. Okay, got it.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So she's awesome, and seeing those two together is awesome.
Nurse Ratched and Skeletor. That's a bad
That's awesome.
Yeah, and it kind of faded. You never saw him again, you know? He faded away into the... I didn't get that. Sorry, I'm jumping ahead.
Yeah. Was there romance hinted somewhat between them? Because there was kind of like an embrace or whatnot, and I didn't know if it was just, you know...
Yeah, they definitely hinted at that. And you know what it reminded me of was Wynn and Dukat. But that's many years away.
Didn't make you wonder if there's like deleted scenes, you know, whether it's a little more than a hint, you know.
Well, I did see in the behind the scenes, the you know, there's that in the circle when Kira has her orb experience, and we see her.
That sounds hot, right? I want to see Kira have orb experience. I want to see her leave maximum orb.
It's naked, they shot it. The two of them naked, but they also shot them kiss when they were naked.
Yeah.
Cut that out of the episode. Mm. Well, this idea, you know, when she has her orb experience, we've kind of hinted around about this before, and I'm still curious about this. But, you know, so you go and the orb's there, and you kind of close your eyes, and now you're somewhere else. Is this the prophets creating this environment and what's going on? Or is this
a hallucinogen released from the orb, or
well, base is it? My question is this more like stuff that her own brain is coming up with? You know,
I look at it as more your conscience, and you know, if you really know your conscience, then you can kind of know what's going on around you. Kind of, like it's just kind of telling you what's really there, what's going on.
Can you guys explain the orbs to me? Because I don't understand any of it. And all of a sudden he opened the box and there was something glowing inside. And she's like, I've waited my whole life for this.
See, in the wormhole, there are these aliens that the Bajorans worship as a kind of deity, like the prophets, they call them. And they, over the multiple millennia, they sent out these orbs. And how many are there? 9, I think. Each one is a different one. The one that Kira used here was the orb of prophecy and change. And the prophets don't really speak directly to the Bajoran people, but they speak indirectly through things like the images that you get when you have an orb experience. And most ordinary Bajorans never get the opportunity because there's so few orbs.
But the orbs themselves are not those aliens. They're something. They're like a
conduit for them.
Yeah, conduit.
Which I understand your question. It's never fully established if this is some message.
They make it more clear, like when you're actually in the wormhole, like when Sisko goes there.
Yeah,
The series is actually communicating with him. Yeah.
Do you want to have a full anybody who hasn't seen the first episode and you've seen this one and you don't have a full understanding, just go back and watch the very, very first episode. It kind of will give you a better explanation of what's going on with these orbs.
Yeah, that's a good point, though. That's probably one of the few things in here that probably makes no sense if you don't know Star Trek, or don't know DS9 anyway.
But you have some trippy... The orb is essentially peyote in a box, right?
It's exactly. Thing.
Okay.
Damn right. Then you smoke a big one right after.
See, hey, when you smoked your orb, was I in your dream? Because you were sure as hell were in mine.
No. You...
Hey, real quick, I got a quick question. Is it just me, or did Dr. Bashir get shot in the cave? Did he actually get shot in the back and just kind of blew
it
that off?
It looked like it, and then he wasn't hurt, right?
Yeah, he just kind of just shrugged it off. Whatever.
Yeah, it was like some kind of really light stun, you know, and he just kind of, you know, and he's back.
My feeling is that they'd be set to kill in those in that type of situation. So... yeah, he shot that phaser blast right off. He's like, yeah, whatever.
I was expecting somebody to say that classic phaser set for stun line, because it seemed like Sisko, every time he was the phaser, he was so off that I thought, is he purposely trying to miss these people or something? Is it just maybe they're set for kill, but they're just, you know, these are warning, they're shots across the bow or something like that? But
it's because it was a three-parter and they had to make these scenes a little longer.
Okay.
Yeah. No.
Later on, you'll learn later on that
is true. In the siege, all those scenes of battle that they have on the station, you know, they set off the smoke bomb and then they run by. I don't know. Maybe that was
flame.
Was it cool in 1993? Maybe, but here it just feels like, all right, moving on. You know, I mean, come on. I had that when I was a kid. I had a little cherry bomb or whatever. I lit it and threw it. You know, but they have like a soccer ball, but he rolls it down there.
You know. Their spaces are so claustrophobic, I think, that they have to use some... The sets don't look that... I mean, I've been in Chuck E. Cheese's that are bigger than the sets for Deep Space Nine. It looks like it's very small, and you have a lot of action that's... You're shooting one group of people in one place and one group of people in another place or whatnot, and they're just... I think that's the whole reason why, right? Is that why the battle scenes are the way they are, is because they're just in this really tight set?
Well, they're not...
I've never thought of them as small, to be honest.
No. Okay.
The pod sets are far larger than, say, I don't know, the Enterprise sets or Voyager sets from the other shows, because those are actually ships.
They only seem large in that they're possibly like multi-story. They're higher, but yeah, they do seem smaller to me. And I do see a lot of repurposed stuff that you see in one shot, you see in the next shot, and the next shot, and the next shot. You never get a wide shot of anybody saying, take me to deck 5 or whatever, and that thing, that elevator thing going down. That's always shot pretty tight. All right.
Yeah,
that's true. I've never actually thought of that. It's an interesting point. Is this?
Well, it's very rare. Like,
it's bigger than I would say Next Gen, because you had the ops is much bigger than the Enterprise on Next Gen, wouldn't you say?
Well, the Promenade is literally a two-story set. You know, they could actually put people up there and shoot scenes up there and see down and stuff. And that's not true of any set on any of the other shows.
Right.
I'm not aware of Star Trek as I am of production value. So I was telling Brian all the time, when I'm watching it, I can see how many people are on set at a given time and how big the area is or whatnot. And that's why the things that I got most excited about was when I saw an establishing shot of something. We were watching it and we saw like the...
There was a matte painting of Bajor that you liked.
I liked that because it was a digital matte painting, it looked like, because it had movement and stuff. And then there was a shot of... Frank Langella and the evil nun looking out the window, and there was actually something out there, right? They were actually standing, and there was something out there, and they were kind of backlit from it and stuff, and that kind of opened it up for me a little bit, because I'm sorry.
Well, a lot of the time, some of it too is time. Now, there were a couple of scenes. I think the Jara wind scene you're talking about was earlier, that was in one of the first two episodes, but there was also a scene in the siege. That was my favorite of the two, with the two of them, and had just gorgeous lighting. And I actually thought, wow, I really like the lighting in here. I remember. It started off with we saw Jaro on the view screen at DS9, and then we kind of cut to where he was on Bajor. And it was kind of like he was almost being lit from underneath a little bit by the screen, and then wind came in behind him and the whole thing, you know. But it's very rare for me to think that, because that's just not...
Right.
Usually these things...
It's television in the mid-90s, pretty much.
Yeah. The shot you're talking about, though, it totally... please continue.
Oh, well, it mostly was a one-camera shoot, but they still yeah. would light it in a way that they didn't really move the lights around much. You know, they did a lot of, you know, you don't see up very high because they leave those lights up there, and so they can move the camera around as quickly as they can. You know, these are long days, but they shot these are 5 or 6 day shoots.
The shot you were talking about is awesome because Frank Langella was actually looking down when he was in the view screen, right? Mm-hmm. And then when they cut to him, he was still looking down. And there's nothing worse than when you're watching one of the recent Star Wars movies and you see the hologram. They're talking to the hologram and they have kind of eye contact with the hologram. But then when you see it from the hologram's point of view, he's not looking at it the same way, you know? He's, you know, it's Darth Vader and he's a little teeny tiny and he's on your console like one of those religious statues. And then all of a sudden you see him and he's standing and he's got holograms of everybody else he's talking to and the eye lines just never match up. So kudos to Frank Langella for nailing that.
Hey, I didn't know we were able to talk about Star Wars on this show. What's
I can't talk about Star Trek without bringing in Star Wars.
I'm just kidding, man. Well,
that does make me want to ask. So Brian, overall, you feel like the production values maybe don't hold up here? Does it feel like it's 20 years old to you? Does it feel like it's 20-year-old TV?
Yeah. It does. But I'm also very aware of the costume design, and not Star Trek, but I've never liked the costume design, especially of televised Star Trek or whatnot, because it already seems dated when you see it. And
What about as compared to other, like a current contemporary show, pacing? Does the pacing feel dated?
I'll tell you how it feels to me is it feels very talky, but I know television has to be talky because they just can't do all that action that you see. They can't cut away and have like a 9-minute chase scene or something like that. So I totally understand it. And they're talking about things that you can't see, you know, because they're talking about, Lee Nellis led this revolution here. You know, if this was Ridley Scott's Star Trek, we'd probably see that, you know, we'd probably get to see it. So I know
a flashback is what you're saying type thing.
I would love to see a flashback when they talked about all this violence in the streets. I'm like, dude, cut away to that, man. Let's see these guys like smashing in windows and stuff. And I know you can't show that stuff. So, but the production, here's the thing that if I could sum it up, I would want it to be a little grittier and dirtier, I suppose, you know, it seems like everything's really nice and clean, but maybe that's the way it's
so contemporary TV. Let's say, I don't know, some of the more recent J.J. Abrams shows or 24. I loved 24.
Battlestar.
These shows are pretty darn talky as well. They certainly don't have the budgets and the action of, say, J.J. Abrams' feature Star Trek. But they do little stuff like, you know, it's, like the way J.J. Abrams moves his camera in every single shot, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is really different. That's the same thing with 24. Like, everything in that show was handheld.
Well, I would say this about DS9, and I would say the same thing about Next Gen. The first 2 to possibly 3 years, in either show, the production value to me was kind of weak. And I don't know if they just got better at it in each series or they got a better budget the further they went along. But the production values in this, at least DS9, the first 2, maybe 3 seasons, the production value isn't top notch. But once you get past the third season, to me it seems like maybe when The Defiant came into play, the production value went up. And I don't know if that was a technology thing or if it was just they got a better budget. Who knows? I'm not really sure.
For me, you know what it is? Honestly, when it's a great, great episode, like, say, Duet at the end of the first season, or mm-hmm. even the final, Enhance the Profits, that last episode of the first season, that's pretty dang good, which is eventually where DS9 is going to get to in almost every episode. When it's that good, it could be, you know, they could make the ships out of used toilet paper, and I would probably not notice.
Tape and popsicle sticks, as long as the story's good. I totally get that.
And Homecoming, The Circle, The Siege, there's so much downtime. There's so much time where it's just like, you know, okay, they're having a 5-minute battle here, and it's just a couple of guys hiding behind smoke. I'm just waiting for them to get to, you know, I don't care.
For the next thing.
You know, there's so much of that that I'm then conscious of it. Then I start to see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there's an episode in the later season with Jake and Nog on the front lines of the Dominion War.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
production value of that is probably no better than any of this, but there's such great drama going on. The story is so good.
Well, yeah, I mean,
you just don't know. You don't see it. You don't think about it.
Unfortunately, then, and we, you know, you're not. It's the story. Yeah, if you have a story like that every time, they'd probably still be making DS9 to this day. But, you know, you have the weaker stories that are filled in with what we just saw. You know, it kind of moves the series along, I would say. But yeah, it's not one of the stronger storylines of DS9 for sure.
Production value wise, this show did something already that it made that Galactica never did, or at least when I watched Galactica, the new Galactica never did, which is to show that they could actually see the characters could actually see what's happening. What's Nana Visitor's name? I forget her name all the time. She's Nana Visitor. Sure. I don't even know her real name.
Sure.
Kira, yeah, when she was in that ship with Dax and she's flying, we cut away several times to actually see what she's seeing, you know, from the cockpit. And I've seen an episode of Battlestar Galactica where Starbuck gets inside the Cylon thing and tries to fly it, and you can never see what she's seeing. There's no way to know where she's going or how she's able to pilot this thing, and it drives me crazy that there's no screens.
That was different because I think they were.
That was different because that ship specifically didn't have a view, have a windows or anything. But when they were in their what they called the raiders or whatever, those you could see out of.
Yeah, but they wanted
to. But I see the point you're making. I definitely see the point that you're making. Actually, that reminds me that there was a. We actually saw a little bit of that battle that was in the daytime, like when the clouds were out and everything.
The sky battle?
That's very unusual for Star Trek. You know, I always think that's a really cool look. We never get to see that. They did that in Insurrection.
Yeah, yeah.
When Picard rescues Data. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there was an original series episode. What's the one? The one with the Air Force captain where they go back in time?
Oh, okay.
Right. One of those similar games. Yeah, yeah.
Was it All Our Yesterdays, or is that a different episode?
I get I'm going to be honest without looking up. It's Tomorrow or Yesterday or some mixture of
something like
words.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
Return to Yesterday, Tomorrow, something. I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
But there was just like, wasn't there like one shot where we saw the 1701 Enterprise just right there in the sky? That was so cool.
Yeah.
You know? So I like those couple of moments we got of that kind of battle here. There's one other thing I just have to ask before we go. Just say if anything we thought these were about. At the beginning of the siege, O'Brien says to Keiko, "We can't let the Cardis have the wormhole." He says Cardis a lot. Am I the only one that every time I hear that sounds like so racist to me? Like we're talking about Battlestar. It's like when the humans in Battlestar call the Cylons toasters. That every time he says Cardis, it seems like such an incredibly racist term.
But we learned about O'Brien. O'Brien, yeah, I mean, because he fought the Cardassians, so he would be...
Yeah, I think it's intentional. I mean, I think they intend for it to come off that way, I think.
But he's the only one...
Bell Gibson blames everything on the Cardis.
Okay, what's Homecoming about? Anybody got anything on that?
Which one is Homecoming?
That's the first one.
Okay.
On this show, we always say, we talk about when we can really easily tell you what the episode's really, truly getting at and what it's really trying to say and what it's really about. And that's very obvious, and it's probably a good episode that holds up. It stands the test of time. So whenever we start talking about, I'm not sure this episode holds up, it probably means we're not going to have a lot for the answer to that question. And today, these first three episodes, I'm going to be in that boat. I'm kind of reaching to give that question an answer. Homecoming. I do like how they start talking about this idea that the symbols are more important than facts sometimes, you know, and that Bajor needs this symbol. They need a legend. So this idea that symbols can be more important than facts, that they're kind of hinting about, you know, maybe that's, if I'm really reaching, that's about all I got out of Homecoming.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the only thing kind of lumping all of them together a little bit, there's a bit of a theme of, you know, not people playing roles and layers to people, you know, what's on the surface isn't always what it appears to be, but sometimes people just have to play the part, you know,
Getting at that and kind of combining that with what I was just saying a second ago, too, I like this idea that... for Lee Nollis, I think this was in the third episode, maybe, but this idea that what does he say? Dying gets you off the hook, you know. Mm-hmm. Instead of dying, to live for your people. Sometimes living is harder. You know, a lot of these episodes today kind of made me think about current events. You know, we had Mubarak step down in Egypt based off on a popular uprising. Mm-hmm. I don't know that the same thing's going to happen in Libya with Gaddafi, because he's totally willing to, you know, the military in Egypt. The military in Egypt was not going to fire on Egyptians, but in Libya, they're mercenaries, and I don't think they have any qualms about firing on the people if Gaddafi asked them to. So I'm not sure that the popular uprising there is going to be successful. But this idea that sometimes it's harder to do nothing, you know?
Yeah.
You just made me think a very scary thought, that the whole Egypt uprising is really supported by someone else we don't know, like the Cardassians. There's a third party pulling all the strings.
Yeah, the Cardassians were giving their phones that let them connect to Facebook.
Exactly.
I don't know. It's dabbling with these ideas, but it's never really hitting any of them on.
I'll leave these episodes on a positive note. Even though they're not the strongest DS9 episodes you'll see, they still have elements of what you'll love about Deep Space Nine. There's a moment between Jake and Sisko early on that's a good scene. I talked about Cork and Odo. There's good things in these episodes. And, you know, we talked about the scene where everybody came into Kira's quarters. That's a great scene. So there are moments, moments in all three of these episodes where you're like, wow, that's kind of cool. So I know we've been kind of down on him, but I mean, and for good reason, but there are good things about these episodes, and those are some of the ones that I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Are we talking about the whole thing, or are we just still talking about the whole thing? Okay. But I would say that after the second episode, I was ready to go. I was like, I even told Brian, I said, I don't even know if I could actually talk about this or not. The third episode kind of nailed it for me, because the third episode had a lot of good, there was a lot of buildup in those first two. And then to get the good stuff in the third episode. So I like the third episode quite a bit.
You know, that reminds, that third episode, there's a lot of stuff in here, especially that third episode that reminded me of, is it the fourth season two-part opener, Way of the Warrior, where they bring on Worf?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think that's the beginning of fourth season, right?
Yeah.
And that's a lot of these things here in these three episodes, they nail those same things. Maybe they miss the mark a little here, but they nail those things. They try again and they nail them in that mm-hmm. two-parter. I definitely want to have Brian back for those, because I think he'll really dig those episodes, especially since he started getting into the CJ a little bit.
These are the ones where the Klingons go crazy, right? And they take
the attack. Big battle station.
Yeah, I definitely want to see that.
All right. So, Brian, if you want to stick around here, I've created trivia questions that I think work even if you're not a Star Trek. No.
Okay. So you're saying just keep your mouth shut until I get to the trivia, right? That's what you're saying?
6 degrees of DS9 for the Season 2 opening trilogy. All right. Mr. Caesar, Mr. Embry, Mr. Mahi. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Here we go.
Mr. Caesar.
All right. Here we go.
Pick a number between 1 and 3.
2.
All right. Number 2. So, Brian, this is our trivia where we... 6 degrees of DS9, 6 degrees of Star Trek, where we connect one actor with another actor. Usually I go with an actor who's played a different role in another episode of Star Trek.
Okay.
But for today, we're going to go with an actor who's worked with another Star Trek person on something that wasn't Star Trek.
How are we going to do steals with two of us? With three of us, rather, all together.
Okay, so the order is alphabetical. Caesar, Embry, Mahi.
All right.
Mr. Caesar picked number 2. Richard Boehmer plays Lee Nollis, famed leader of the Bajoran Resistance, rescued by Kira and O'Brien. Boehmer is best known for starring in 1961's West Side Story.
I totally know who that is now. Okay, I wonder why I look familiar. Yeah. I get it now.
Yeah. That film was directed by the same gentleman that directed Star Trek The Motion Picture. What was his name?
Oh, crap. Star Trek the Motion Picture. I should know this.
His first big gig was editor of Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
And he won an Oscar. I'm pretty sure. Did he win the Oscar for West Side Story, or was he just... The movie won Best Picture, right?
Yeah. He wasn't the only director on West Side Story, because did the other guy get a credit, the guy that got fired partway through, or not?
Yeah, I know you're talking. I don't know if he got a credit or not. But this same director also did Sound of Music a couple years later.
Yeah, he's got a lot of credits, this guy. I don't remember his name.
Weiss, am I right?
Yeah,
there?
That's right. Robert Weiss.
Robert Weiss.
Okay. Robert Weiss.
You got it.
I was thinking of Daniel. You remember Daniel Weiss?
Oh, right.
I will never think of Lee Nolles the same now that I know he's from West Side Story. Yeah. It's going to be when you're a Bajor.
That's the key. If they would have had song to this, that would have taken
Oh, my God. That would have been awesome. He pulled out a knife and started snapping his fingers.
Yeah, I got one. You got one. All right. So if we quit now, then you win.
Yep.
Mr. Embry, you're second. So pick either number one or three.
One.
Number one. Frank Langella plays the scheming leader of the Circle. In 1987, he starred with Star Trek Voyager's Robert Duncan McNeil in what fantasy adventure film? You're pausing for effect now. You see, Brian, I've instructed them to always pause so that.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing to do because
yes,
I'm embarrassed that I knew this one. I didn't know Robert Wise's name.
Yep.
Well, to be honest with you, this sounds familiar, but it's not. I'm not going to be able to come up with it. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Can I add something to it?
Yeah, but Brian, you understand that Brian has already basically given you the answer to this several times during today's episode.
That's right.
That's right. Oh, okay, I don't know, man.
As one of the cast of Friends is in it. How's that?
Yeah, but no, but Brian, he's going to give up, and then you get to get it, and you steal his pregnancy.
I like helping.
That's cool. I don't know, man. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Brian, you know the answer.
It is the masterpiece known as Masters of the Universe.
That is correct.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Langella plays Skeletor, and Robert Duncan McNeil is the guy with the keyboard.
But wasn't his name Lieutenant Commander something on Voyager? What's his name? He's a pilot on Voyager, right?
Yeah,
Paris.
Right. Paris. Yeah.
Paris. That's right.
Who from Friends was Courtney Cox?
Courtney Cox. She's Robert Duncan McNeil's girlfriend.
Yeah.
And I also have seen that since it was out, you know, yeah, the first time.
I'm with you, Steven.
If you guys would like to join me on my Masters of the Universe cast, we talk about how.
All right. How many seasons of He-Man are there?
Well, we've already gone through them. We're on the She-Ra episodes now. And,
okay. You know,
that's what I try. Hey, Brian, call me when you get to the Christmas special. I'm there.
Is there really a Christmas special?
Yeah.
She-Ra.
I believe there is.
Yeah, there's.
Yeah, the cartoons I know. I know the.
Okay, Brian. Bruce Gray plays Vice Admiral Chakotay. Not really Chakotay. We'll call him Chakotay. Bruce Gray plays Vice Admiral Chakotay and orders Sisko and crew to evacuate DS9, an order Sisko promptly ignores. In 1997, he appeared in a Paul Verhoeven sci-fi film that starred Star Trek Nemesis's Dina Meyer. Name that film.
You say 1987 or 1997?
97.
Okay, that would have to be Starship Troopers.
You are correct. It is Starship Troopers. All right. Dina Meyer.
Look at the new guy, too.
Yeah. He asked questions about Star Trek that somehow related to film in general, and that's how it
Starship Troopers does still hold up, unlike Masters of the Universe.
The first Starship Troopers holds up.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
That's like saying the first Psycho holds up, but the other ones are bad.
Or the first Chinatown holds up.
You know, the first Beethoven movie was great. Then it got unrealistic.
Just goes downhill from there.
It went downhill from there, exactly. They fired the original writers.
Well, Brian, it's been great having you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.
And we will definitely have you back.
Fantastic.
If you want to come back. But we are going to move on to another episode. So we'll see you next time, Brian, and everyone else. Okay. Hang on.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Invasive Procedures, Season 2, Episode 4, Production Number 424. Original air date, October 17th, 1993. Teleplay by John Willoughby and Robert Hewitt Wolf. Story by John Willoughby. Directed by Les Landau. Guest cast include John Glover as Farah, Megan Gallagher as Muriel, Tim Russ as Takar, and Steve Rankin as Yeto.
Varad, an unjoined Trill, takes over Deep Space Nine. He holds the crew hostage and steals the Dax symbiont from Jadzia to implant into himself. The rest of the crew try to regain control of the station so that they may place the Dax symbiont back into Jadzia before she dies.
I want Dax.
She's not going anywhere with you.
No, I don't want the girl. I only want what is rightfully mine, what should have been mine years ago. I want Dax.
This is an episode that I think it holds up. You know, I always kind of remembered it. Here's the neat thing about this episode. One way that I know it holds up, I can never really remember. It always seems like it must have been from the fifth or sixth season, you know?
Right. Yeah, I can see
you
that.
Know, it doesn't feel like a opening of season two kind of thing. And generally those are the times that's probably because I tend to remember those later episodes better because the show gets better and better. So whenever I like this episode where I'm like, that must have been later, and that wasn't season two. Yeah, so like it's indicative that it's one of the better episodes.
And I think on the whole, these Trill things work so well. I don't know if it's just an interesting, this whole notion of a species that carries on over multiple lifetimes. I think it lends itself to good stories. You know, you have a lot of to explore there.
Yeah, you get a very deep character out of Jadzia because of that. I mean, it must have been, I don't know, you know, I'm not an actor or anything like that, but it must have been nice to have a character like that where you could draw from so many different things. Mm-hmm. It could be explained very easily. Well, I used to fly a plane in my past life.
there are a lot of great Trill episodes to come, you know, and then, of course, what happens in the last season gives them so many new places to go. Mm-hmm. But with the Trill species, where's the episode where we actually go to the Trill homeworld for the first time? Is that? It's not this season.
I think
maybe
it's
season three.
I would guess season
three or four. Yeah. That's where, because in this episode is the first time we ever hear that, you know, only a small number of Trill are actually joined. I think it's a 1 in 10. I think is what she says. But then, of course, in season three, if that's where that episode is, we discovered that the reason actually isn't because psychologically they have to be a perfect match. If I recall, it's just because they don't have that many symbiotes, right?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So they kind of come up with this nonsense, right? Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, this whole episode to me is worth it for the one scene, for the scene where they take the symbiote out of Jadzia Dax, leaving her as just Jadzia, right? And then Bashir wakes her up. And so she wakes up for a moment without the symbiote.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, I've never felt so empty. And she looks so scared and vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's a really cool thing that they can do writing wise, and her performance is so great, because before that, you know, she's willing, the Dax part of her, the smart part of her, not that, that came out you know, her she's able to use her past experience and her intelligence and stuff and to say I'm willing to sacrifice myself to save my friends, because, you know, Varad threatens to kill her friends if she doesn't go through with this procedure. But then when she wakes up without that part of her anymore, you know, she no longer has that level of logic that you get from lifetimes of experience. And she's just, you know, she's very young all of a sudden. All of a sudden, you know, mortality is terrifying in a way that it wasn't a few minutes before, and in a way that it doesn't seem fair a few minutes before. That's a really neat place to go with this character, and it's the scene that makes the entire episode worth it to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's cool. It's because it's something you know you can only do in this format, because we all wonder, I think, at some time or another, what if I could take out this experience or this part of my brain or something, and what would I be like? You know, and you, in this case, actually explore that. You know.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. It's such a it's such a wild opportunity for them. Not just for Trek, but for any kind of storytelling, you know, how specific this experience is. And that's really great. And then we get some other cool stuff. We get the angry Sisko.
You know? He gets angry real good. He's almost likable when he's angry.
Yeah. I always remember, you know, Steve, from many years ago, I remember speaking with you like the night after, oh God, the episode where Worf is like on trial for destroying a freighter or something that turned out to have weapons or something like that.
Right.
But at the time, you know, he was on trial because they thought it might have people or something. And it turned out he was right and everything was cool. But then Sisko is quietly talking to him, and he says, "What have we?" Something like, I'm paraphrasing, "What have we learned here?" And Worf says something like, "I should have checked first." And he's like, "You're damn right."
Yeah.
I remember talking to you, Steve, like the next day, and you're like, "Man, I love it when he gets like that." You know, we get a little bit of that here. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not friends anymore. You know, he goes from that. Like they're laughing and talking about their history together to, hi, and now that woman is bleeding to death in the infirmary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, just such a stops it right there. Yeah.
180, you know, and the rest of them are sitting there too, kind of you know, you don't know what, I mean, obviously they're not thinking, I'm sure, that Sisko is just going to play it off and have a good time, but they're kind of just all like disgusted and that he's having a friendly chat with this guy doing this, you know, and then he turns it on.
Well, you know, when you look at Sisko, he's able to, throughout the series, he's able to change and play that, so you don't know, like what you're saying, you know, about later on with Worf, you know, it seems like they're getting along, and then he yells at Worf, whereas, like, maybe you look at Picard, you always knew when Picard was in a bad mood. It was, you know, Sisko's able to do a 180 real quick.
Yeah, one of the interesting questions this episode kind of asks for me, which we've gotten before, about the Trill. You know, we had that episode in the first season where she was on trial, and are you responsible for the actions of your younger self? That was our metaphorical relationship to the episode, but were you responsible for the actions of your previous host or whatever? Kind of a variation on that we get at here, which is an interesting question to me, is how much of a Trill is a blending versus kind of a relationship?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think about that here, because like the end of this episode, Varat is confronted by Sisko. Sisko has a phaser, and he walks by him to get on the ship to leave the station, and he says, "You're not going to shoot me. I know you. You're not going to shoot me." And Sisko turns around and says, "Don't call me Ben," or something. And he shoots him.
Right.
So he believed that Sisko wouldn't shoot him based on how the Dax symbiote knew Sisko.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So how much is it a relationship between, say, Jadzia and Dax, or Varat and Dax? And how much of it is the pure blending?
Right. And it's hard to say, because, I mean, I think the only way to for us to know that were to see a larger sample size and a longer time with and without a symbiont. You know, well, I mean, it's obviously subjective. But
if it had been Jadzia, would she have made the same guess about Sisko not shooting?
Right.
See, that's the kind of thing I'm wondering about here.
Yeah, it's
he's wrong.
It's obviously a conundrum. I mean, but yeah, I mean, I see where you're coming with that, with the thing, but I don't know. That's a tough question. I'd have to think about it. Maybe get back to you in the next episode. But yeah, that's a very interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought of it that way. Relationship and a blending.
because she says she feels empty in the scene when it's removed, when the symbiote is removed. You know, she still seems like she's Jadzia Dax in a way. She just, you know, her change, it's a simpler one than what John Glover character goes through Varad, which he does a great job, by the way, of playing these two different people. You know, kind of unusual role for him. I don't know. I always remember him for the stuff that probably aren't the first things that come to other people's minds. I loved him in was it Gremlins 2? That movie. he was one of the bad gangster guys. And what was that Mel Gibson? The Point Blank remake? Payback.
Oh, Payback.
Yeah, he was one of those guys. So it's kind of an interesting role for him, and it's so obvious when he goes from being the kind of stuttery, unsuitable, the way he says unsuitable and mediocrity, the stuttery guy into the Varad Dax guy. Mm-hmm. And I always talk about how I love these episodes that are you know, the station empties out. So here we got a plasma storm, which is cool effects, by the way. So the station empties out, and we're left with just our senior people on the ship, on the station. I always like those.
Sorry, I'm still thinking about your question, the relationship and everything. Yeah, no, seriously.
That's what this, you know, for me, what is this episode about? That's what it's about.
Because you look at, I mean, you have the character of Rod, he comes in and, you know, he's obviously feels like he's not adequate unless he has a symbiont. So which is it? Is it the blending that he's looking for? Is it the relationship? And could you translate that into, like, you know, how would you translate that into our society? Because I like to look at Trek as a mirror of us in a way. So, you know, do you actually need somebody in your life to be complete, or can you be complete on your own? It's interesting.
And I do. You talk about, like, what's it about, and, you know, I mean, I think that's, you know, you go that direction, what you spoke of. But I do think this is an episode. This is one of these kind of episodes, though, that the strength of the episode is, sure, it's got depth and meaning in the story, but it does rely a lot on this sci-fi element of the Trills that makes the writing so. Makes it so interesting, you know, going into a species and pondering these things, like you said, you know. I think it relies a lot on that. I think it's easier in some ways to when you're exploring a species and their backstory and logistics of how they work and stuff. You know, you can dwell on that a lot, and you know, not have to be like the perfect, you know, moral or theme or something to the story. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and what a cool, like, canvas to play on. I mean, it's not like they didn't have a book for this. We know now this is all established canon for what the Trill species is. They were just writing this stuff.
Yeah.
This big empty.
Well, I mean, let me ask you guys this: do you think, because you know, on a normal episode basis, we don't think of Jadzia Dax as two separate beings? Would you agree? I mean,
right, we're aware of it. She's like, it's not like we ponder it. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, they have these episodes from time to time where it's made very distinct that she is two people in a manner of speaking. What do you think they're trying to, I mean, is it just good storytelling, or do you think they're trying to say something with this?
Well, I think that's an interesting question about do we need someone else to define who we are? And that's probably different depending on, you know, there are some people that I'm probably one of those persons. I can't imagine who I would be without my immediate family. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't separate myself from that.
Mm-hmm.
But you could take it a little bit deeper too. There are aspects of yourself that, you know, so you could say that each one of it, we have, like, different parts of ourself already. Mm-hmm. You know, you have, you know, to an extreme, you have your angry self, you have your happy self. I know there's the kind of extreme sides of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we it's touched like on multiple this. Personalities. In a
yeah,
way.
Yeah, yeah. And we touched on this when on that last the last big Trill episode where she's on trial. The whole notion of, I think Brian, you brought up the analogy of someone who's a juvenile commits a crime, then later in life, you know, really who they are. Mm-hmm. This kind of thing that you're. It's partly like the people around you that is kind of the symbolic of the Dax and Jadzia, but it's also your collected experiences and you know, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, it's definitely a fascinating character that we'll have more discussions on as I know we'll have more discussions on as time goes on.
Right, right.
Well, it's another cool statement on how far the show has come, you know, and how all these characters are defined so much with each other. They're defined so much because of their relationships with one another. One of the things we didn't mention from the previous three episodes, you know, this is the opening of the second season, and there was that moment at the beginning of the second episode, where they're all in Kira's quarters, and Burrell comes in, and she's like, no, it's okay, these people are just, and she's like, pauses for a moment, it's just, they're my friends.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm.
Even Quark.
Yeah, even Quark. 6 degrees for invasive procedures.
All right.
Okay. Now, today, because I know you guys don't like episode titles, I've got an episode title, but I made it multiple choice.
Nice.
Okay, Caesar, you went first last time, so Steve, pick one or two.
One.
Number one. All right, so you get the multiple choice. Here we go. Tim Russ plays the Klingon mercenary T'Kar in this episode, but he is best known to Trek fans as Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager. But this was not his first Trek role. He co-starred on an episode of Next Gen where Picard was trapped aboard the Enterprise with terrorist thieves. Name the episode.
And you like know I said, what? I don't think I need the choices.
Oh my God, look at that. All right.
Yeah, but I'm going to pause so our viewers can ponder it. Perhaps sure. You'd like to give the choices to the viewer. No, I'm just playing.
I worked so hard to come up with choices.
You should give the choices to the viewer.
All right.
Yeah.
The listener, right. The Starship Down, Starship Mine, Starship Lost.
I believe the answer is Starship Mine.
You are correct. It's Starship Mine. was that, I think a reference to Enemy Mine. I don't know.
Wow.
I just kind of wondered about that. Okay, Mr. Caesar.
Yes.
Steven Rankin plays Yeto, the Klingon mercenary that gets duped by Dr. Bashir and Quark. He also played Patak in the third season Next Gen episode, The Enemy. In The Enemy, what Next Gen crew member is the only viable donor that can save the life of an injured Romulan aboard the Enterprise?
Pause. All right, you guys out there have had enough time. That would be Worf.
You are correct. That is Worf. Very good. Wow, like, I didn't stump anybody today, did I? Oh, no. Steve, you did not get Masters of the
Universe. Yeah, was
You're never going to live that down.
I was kind of lost in space in that one. I don't know what was that.
Yeah. Franklin Jella as Skeletor got you. Okay, gentlemen. Thank you for another Wunderbar show. And we will be doing the next four episodes of season two in a couple of weeks.
All right.
So check us out on the web at trekcompanion.com. Email us at trekcompanion@gmail.com. I did establish a Facebook fan page. I'm still working on that. So moving right along.
Good night, guys.
Take it easy.
All right. See you.